On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Syria is a nightmare right now. Shelling, shooting, death toll rising. The Arab League has met, monitored, and left. The UN Security Council met and failed to get a resolution. Ambassadors are being recalled. The U.S. Embassy closed. The old order of the dictator Assad is surely, likely, maybe over. But the only way forward seems to be full-blown civil war. This is going to test the region and the world. This hour On Point, looking carefully at Syria. You can join the conversation. Are you hearing the thud of Syrian government shells falling on the Syrian people? What is the right response? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In the 4 days since the UN resolution and the Security Council failed, Syrian forces have pummeled opposition stronghold in Homs. In that time alone, hundreds are reported, have been reported, killed by heavy shelling and machine gun fire. Here's Al Jazeera English reporting on the bombardment.
Striking again at the heart of the uprising. But this time, with what seems like a determination to break the resistance once and for all.
That may be wishful thinking. This has gone on for 11 months now, and it doesn't look to be breaking. Joining me today first from next door in Beirut, Lebanon, is Abigail Fielding-Smith, Beirut correspondent for the Financial Times. Abigail, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. What's the latest on Homs and the government's bombardment there? Does it go on as far as you know?
Yes, there's been no indication of a let-up in the bombardment. I spoke to an activist earlier today who told me that there was shelling every 4 to 5 minutes and machine gun fire every few seconds. It sounds very scary. The latest death toll estimate that I was given was that I think around 15 people were killed today in Homs, on top of what, as you said, has already been a very, very bloody few days there.
We heard Al Jazeera English saying there that the intensity of the attack on protesters, opposition, Homs looks like an effort on the part of the Assad government to break the opposition once and for all. Is that possible? Isn't it more widespread than Homs? Is there such a thing as breaking the opposition at this point in this long struggle, Abigail?
Yes, it's certainly more widespread than Homs. Homs, however, has had a sort of symbolic significance as one of the centres of resistance, and particularly armed resistance to the regime. It was dubbed the capital of the revolution at one point. And in the areas where they're shelling armed fighters, people calling themselves the Free Syrian Army and other types of armed fighters are thought to have been very strong. So you can see why symbolically it would be important for them to show strength by attacking these areas in Homs. But what's interesting is that whilst they are shelling these areas, and they do seem to be under very sustained attack, as far as I'm aware, they haven't actually been able to enter them with ground troops, which gives an indication of how difficult it is for them to maintain control, even in a relatively limited area, when there's a sustained attack going on there.
Abigail, many outside Syria are at this point asserting that sooner or later the government of Bashar al-Assad is finished, that it's, it can fight, it can resist, but it's over. Is that the sense you get from the reporting you're able to do inside Syria?
I think it's very difficult to see how the situation can be sustained in the long term. Not least because of financial factors. When the EU introduced sanctions on oil exports from Syria, it deprived them of a huge source of foreign currency. And even with assistance from allies such as Russia, it's very difficult to see, even on the financial front, this going on in the long term. But clearly, as we've seen, the regime is very determined. And in some ways, I think it does believe itself to be strong. And I think obviously this, in the short to medium term at least, this veto at the Security Council a few days ago will have given them a fillip. So whilst, yes, in the long term it does seem unsustainable, I think everyone at the moment on the ground in Syria is focusing on the sort of immediate future, and it's very hard to see how it's going to be decisively resolved one way or another.
The Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov is in Damascus now talking with the Assad government. There were a lot of people lining the streets to cheer and greet him after Russia vetoed the UN Security Council resolution that would have put more pressure on Damascus. He's talking about brokering some kind of agreement, some kind of peace agreement. Does that look plausible, or is that Russian window dressing on a difficult moment?
Well, certainly. I mean, when the Russians earlier invited the opposition to come and have a dialogue with the regime in Moscow, people from the Syrian National Council, which is the main umbrella group for the Syrian opposition, were very quick to dismiss that. They said there's no dialogue that they can have with the regime, that their demand is that Mr. Assad goes, and that they don't trust the regime. So, yes, it's very hard to see how any kind of dialogue would be acceptable to people at this point. And, you know, there's just no trust, really, that the regime is someone that you can have dialogue with.
Finally, Abigail, what's going on there is described as an uprising, but increasingly people are saying, well, this is an incipient, at this point, civil war. Does it look that way to you?
Well, certainly if you were to look at the situation in certain places where there's been very intense fighting between the army, which has certainly been taking casualties, heavy casualties, and armed opponents of the regime, it does look like a civil war. Homs has often looked like a civil war. But we have to remember, you know, there's a larger country. I think, you know, to some extent it's a question of semantics to say whether we're in a civil war yet or not. Clearly, in terms of the military firepower, the regime has the overwhelming advantage. But I think what we are going to start to see now that diplomatic efforts have had such a setback at the UN, is more support for the Free Syrian Army or whatever the sort of latest iteration of the sort of armed resistance is calling itself. And I suspect that we will see an increase in funding and resources going to it as well.
And more pressure. We're just reading here from the AP. The Six Nation Gulf Cooperation Council says it is pulling its ambassadors from Syria because of President Bashar al-Assad's refusal to accept Arab attempts to end that country's bloodshed. Abigail Fielding-Smith reporting on Syria there from Beirut, Lebanon, for the Financial Times. Thank you very much for being with us, Abigail.
Thank you, Sean.
This morning, NPR's Morning Edition spoke by phone to a Syrian citizen journalist, blogger, opposition member, Omar Shakir, holed up in Baba Amr, a neighborhood of homes, where they're seeing some of the heaviest shelling and crackdown by regime forces.
Those last 3 days were the most violence since the beginning of this revolution, okay? You can hear the heavy machine gun now because I opened the window.
Open the window and you hear heavy machine gun. Death toll in the last 11 months, maybe 5,000, 6, some are saying 7. And lots of hot talk about what to do about it. In an interview with MSNBC Monday morning, President Obama was asked whether the U.S. would result to military intervention in Syria.
I think it is very important for us to try to resolve this without recourse to outside military intervention. I think that's possible. My sense is that you're seeing more and more people inside of Syria recognizing that they need to turn a chapter. The Assad regime is feeling the noose tightening around them. This is not going to be a matter of if, it's going to be a matter of when.
A matter of when, said the president on Monday, but it could be a long time, and it's already a very bloody time. Joining us right now is Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Runs a blog called SyriaComment.com, widely read in Washington, Europe, and Syria. Joins us today from Norman, Oklahoma, but all plugged in on the Syria front. Joshua Landis, thank you very much for being with us.
How are you, Tom?
I'm okay.
Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. What is the moment that we've reached here, Josh Landis, as you see it?
Well, with the collapse of the UN efforts to put increasing pressure on Assad and to develop some kind of leverage over him, the Syrian regime feels that it has it's got a little window, and it's going to, as you've shown already, is pounding the opposition in Homs and trying to get control of this opposition, which has grown and is increasingly taking more territory in Syria.
But the president of the United States is saying that Assad's ouster, or at least the end of his regime one way or another, is just a matter of when, just a matter of time. Do you agree?
Well, I do. I do agree. Of course, the time factor is the most important thing. I mean, if you want to put it in context, what we have going in Syria today is in part a struggle over form of government and so forth, but in part it's also a struggle between religious groups. The Alawites, who are 12% of Syria, who dominate the security forces, the presidency, and the Sunni opposition, which is been growing in leaps and bounds. Mm-hmm. But if we look across the Middle East, what we see is the end of a post-colonial era in the Levant.
The colonial powers, the British and the French, they set it up for minorities to rule, and that's falling apart.
Exactly. You know, we saw in Lebanon the Christians had been given a leg up by the French after the Second World War, and they were fought tooth and nail by the Muslims in a 15-year civil war. And the Muslim forces used democracy as their main challenge, saying one man, one vote, mm-hmm. and the Christians had more votes. We saw this in Iraq too with the Sunnis. The Sunni minority had been put into power by the British during their colonial period, and finally the Shiites shoved them aside. Now, of course, the American military did it for them, the heavy lifting, but the Sunnis didn't give up. They fought tooth and nail to stay, and they still are fighting to gain power there.
If we get civil war in Syria, we could see that feeding right over the border into Iraq and that whole civil conflict as well. Joshua Landis, there's a lot more we want to understand in this hour. It's become even more urgent in the last few days. We're glad you're with us. Listeners, you can join us. Have you seen the death tolls out of Syria? Heard the machine gun fire? Is this for Syrians to work out for themselves? At what cost? Should the world intervene? 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the killing and the way forward in Syria, the bloodbath, the powder keg, the challenge there right now to the world. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the death tolls, heard the shelling, the machine gun fire? What should happen here? Is this for Syrians to work out for themselves? At what cost? Should the world, the U.S., intervene? How? Are Russia and China craven to veto UN resolution on this? Are they right? And if Assad goes, does civil war have to follow? What would that mean? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Here's sound from an amateur video taken by the opposition yesterday in the midst of the shelling in Homs. Shows a makeshift field hospital, and in it, a small room where a couple of people are being operated on as they lie unconscious on the floor. Reality on the ground in Homs. Here's the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. on CNN on Monday with unusually undiplomatic things to say about Russia and China after they vetoed a U.N. resolution that would have called for Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad to step down.
They put a stake in the heart of efforts to resolve this conflict peacefully. The resolution on the table would have done nothing more than have encouraged the Arab League in their efforts to bring the two sides to a negotiated settlement and a transition to democracy. So they have, by their actions, by their veto, dramatically increased the risk of greater violence, and we've seen the manifestations of that, and indeed increased the risk of civil conflict.
Disgusting. U.S. U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice called it a travesty. Hillary Clinton called it during the debate over the Security Council resolution at the U.N. Chinese Ambassador Li Baodong explained why China objected to the resolution.
China maintains that under the current circumstances, to put undue emphasis on pressuring the Syrian government, prejudge the result of the dialogue or impose any solution will not help resolve the Syrian issue, but instead may further complicate the situation.
There's a Chinese argument. Russia, of course, long-time relations with Syria at the heart of its Middle East policy throughout the Cold War. It's got its only Mediterranean port on the Syrian coast. Joshua Landis joins us, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Joshua, there's so much to get into. I think Americans don't know a lot of this Syrian reality and Syrian history. What about this fundamental problem? You've had a country governed and sometimes brutally governed by the Alawite 12% minority for so many years. Now Sunnis are saying, come on, we've got Arab Spring, we want democracy, and we're fed up with this. You know, how do you get a change in status quo here without a complete bloodbath, without a civil war? Is it possible? Is there some negotiated way forward?
Well, it's hard to see. You know, people have hoped that there would be. But if we look at the region, we've seen the same paradigm very bloodily carried out in every Levantine country. Lebanon, 15-year civil war. Iraq, what is going on to almost a decade of violence and car bombs and so forth because the Shia pushed out the – in Palestine, Israel, the Jewish minority, when the British left, beat the Muslims and Christians, the Palestinians, and have turned themselves into the majority, making it quite unique. And but that's been a very violent process, lots of wars. In all of these countries, Syria now, you're seeing the Alawites and other minorities too, because the Christians and Druze and other minorities support this government against the fearful of the Sunni majority. And that's going to give way. The minority cannot rule forever. And they've had 40 years and they've failed. They failed to deliver economically and politically.
But you've got at least one Sunni sheikh there in Syria saying, you know, let's go after the Alawite minority and turn them into mincemeat once we take over here. You know this country well. I believe you're married to an Alawite Syrian. I mean, how do you get to some kind of acceptable status quo on the other side of this standoff?
Well, I wish I had an answer to that. I don't, you know, I don't see it. From the beginning of this conflict, I've said that there isn't a soft landing for this regime. They have worked themselves, as you say, into a sort of fevered anxiety that Muslim fundamentalists are coming. And that that bodes ill for a negotiated democratic transition of power.
And that's not just the Alawites who rule, but the Christian, very often business class, that surround and are allied with them at this point.
Yes, indeed. And they're all, you know, they're looking at Egypt, they're looking at Tunisia, they're looking at the growth of the success of the Muslim Brotherhood in these other countries. And they're saying, boy, we don't want that here. On the other hand, if you're going to have democracy, you have to accept what the people, you know, what the majority wants.
The complicating layer here is that this is not, as if that's not complicated enough, the sort of arrangement that was left by the colonial powers when they moved out, is that you have all kinds of very current international interests flowing through here. And I wish you'd describe some of those interests. Iran, Russia, the U.S., right. Israel, the Gulf states for that matter. Describe the threads of interest that run, more than threads, that run through Syria now.
Well, you have seen a sort of a reemergence of a Cold War scenario here because there are two major alliances in the Middle East, Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and now Iraq has joined this alliance now that it's Shiite. So there's sort of a Shiite crescent that some people refer to it, or a resistance against Saudi Arabia, Israel, used to be Egypt. Of course, Egypt is sort of falling out of that. And the United States, the Gulf, who are Sunni powers with Israel and the United States who are very much against Iran. And those two are – there's a big tug of war. So Russia and China have are backing Syria because they see if Syria falls and moves into the U.S. camp with the Sunnis and the Saudi camp, that's going to put a lot of pressure on Iran. And if Iran falls, then the Soviet – then, excuse me, the Russia has a very little foothold in the Middle East, and China has big investments in Iranian oil and gas and so forth and sees it as a major source of their future energy supply.
So this tension over Syria is a kind of proxy for big power interests in Iran?
Yes, indeed. That is sort of the end game, and many people in Washington see this as a way to weaken Iran and to sort of kick out the one leg of this three-legged stool, which props up Hezbollah in Lebanon and Iran on the other side.
Hezbollah brings us to the doorstep of Israel. How do Israel's interests relate to the conflict in Syria then?
Well, that's a very – Israel has been biting its fingernails on this and hasn't – you know, they've said the devil we don't know is better than a devil we know. That's the official line of the embassy here in the United States.
We know Assad, so, and it's not pretty, but it's been around a long time and it's been stable.
No, just the opposite. They've
said
we don't want – we're willing to give up Assad even though he's been stable. He's a known enemy.
What, because he's been funding Hezbollah and so much else for so long?
He has supported Hezbollah.
For that funding, yeah.
Right. Israel conquered a big hunk of Syrian territory in 1967 and still owns it. And Syria wants it back and has supported resistance in every way possible.
Yeah.
Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran. And so there's still a big bone of contention. But Assad has never, you know, since 1973, the Syrian border with Israel has been the most peaceful border. If Assad falls, in many ways, Syria today as it is the best for Israel because the Arabs are weak. They're fighting amongst themselves. Mm. Syria cannot help Hezbollah right now. But if he falls and there should be civil war, Islamist militias, and this is going to, of course, heighten anxiety in Israel. So Israel has something to gain if a pro-Western government emerges and there's a solid government to replace Assad and then it moves into the sort of pro-Israel Saudi Arabia-America camp. Mm. But it also has something to lose if Syria turns into a chaotic place like Iraq with militias and possible al-Qaeda and so forth. And that's what they fear.
And just to make all this a little more vivid, as if it's not vivid enough for people in homes right now under that artillery shelling and heavy machine gun fire, how does the Iran situation, the accusations of nuclear weapons development, the heightening volume of talk we hear about in a potential Israeli attack on Iran and therefore one way or another American involvement in that war with Iran, how does that factor into the Syria situation?
Well, as you know, the war drums have been getting louder and economic sanctions on Iran, the West has been increasing economic sanctions on Iran and trying to put a squeeze on it in order to give up its attempts to refine uranium mm-hmm. and to move towards militarization of the bomb. At least that's the accusation. So in a sense, bringing down Syria, changing the government in Syria is good for Israel and the United States if they want to hurt Iran. For Russia and China, it's bad. Saudi Arabia is sitting there very much hoping for regime change in Syria and for a Sunni government that would then be allied with Saudi Arabia. So that's the dynamic, and that's why the GCC has pulled their ambassador out of Syria along with the United States and the Western powers, while Russia and China is defending it.
We've got a powder keg and a lot of pain there right now. Joshua Landis, stand by at the University of Oklahoma. I want to go right now to Houston, Texas, and Ambassador Edward Jerajian. He is a founding director of the Baker Institute at Rice University. He was U.S. ambassador to Syria in the Reagan and first Bush administrations, assistant secretary of state for Near Eastern Affairs for George H.W. Bush and the Clinton administrations, ambassador to Israel in the Clinton administration. Ambassador Jerajian, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
What are the United States' options at this point, Ambassador?
Well, first, I think a point of wisdom I hope that everyone in capitals outside of the region will understand is that no outside power will be able to dictate the course of events inside Syria. This is a spontaneous uprising from the bottom up, which is part of the so-called Arab Spring or Arab Awakening. But there are certainly things that major powers especially can do both in the region and outside. And I think the important goal is to do everything possible immediately to try to stop the killing because we are on the cusp of a major humanitarian disaster in Syria. And secondly, to engage in whatever effective ways we can to promote a political transition in Syria. It is no doubt in my mind that this regime is finished. It has lost its legitimacy totally. It still has adherents. It is in charge of a very effective, tightly controlled a group of political, military, intelligence, and to date, elite business interests mm-hmm. That are able to control the gun and control the basic cities of Damascus and Aleppo. But I think that's the catalyst for real change and rather rapid change is when the streets in Aleppo and Damascus start to move. They're able to keep power despite the very bloody confrontations taking place in the cities mm-hmm. in Syria. But when the capital and Aleppo move, that is truly the beginning of the end.
How does the regime end if it is so attached to at least 12%, the Alawite 12% of the country, Syrians who may feel very vulnerable to reprisal of all kinds if the regime goes down. And beyond that, 12%, the Christian minority in Syria, you've got very substantial populations here. Is it, you know, would just, let's say, removing Assad or even 100 or 1,000 people around him pull that thorn of contention in this country and move it away from reprisal, even away from civil war?
Well, that's the nightmare scenario, is sectarian strife, akin to what we saw in the tragic civil war in Lebanon, and akin to what we saw after we invaded Iraq and the sectarian violence in Iraq. All of these countries are multi-confessional societies, and basically this is one of the reasons, the fear, and the legitimate fear of sectarian strife in Syria, that the international community and the Arab countries gave Bashar al-Assad what I call a pass when the Arab Spring came to Damascus, despite the arrogance of the regime saying that they were immune to what was happening in the rest of the Arab world. Well, with the events in Daraa, where the uprising in Syria first started, that arrogance was proved to be just totally baseless. And the thing is that the international community, especially because of its fear of major destabilization in Syria and confessional strife, and what you mentioned, various groups going against one another, is one of the reasons every effort was made to give Bashar al-Assad a pass, some political space, so that he would get in front of the curve of reforms.
But he was given years, and that didn't happen.
Well, he was given years, and I remember meeting with him way back in 2003. And I mentioned to him, I said, you know, Mr. President, you've come to power as a young reformist, modernist president, yet we don't see the reforms really moving forward. And I'll never forget what he told me. He said, you know, Ambassador, the people have to be ready for structural reforms. They're not. Therefore, I will start incrementally administrative reforms. Now, that's way back in 2003, but I was truly struck when the first public announcements from the Ba'athist regime in Damascus after the uprising in March of 2011, I heard the same refrain in different words, but that reforms will be incrementally introduced at the will of the regime. He simply didn't get it, and he wasn't able to get out in front of it.
Joshua Landis, do you see any possibility of Assad accepting some kind of withdrawal here, stepping out of the picture in such a way that might open a path to a negotiated settlement to this giant standoff?
I don't, frankly. I wish it were possible, but looking at the region, you just don't see any precedent for that. There have, you know, unfortunately, the sectarian groups see this as an all or nothing game, and the fear on their part is that something would happen to them, like what happened to the Sunnis in Iraq. Once the Shiites won, they went through, outlawed the Ba'ath Party, took out all the Ba'athists, got rid of the military. Hundreds of thousands of Sunnis lost their jobs and their livelihoods. Something similar may very well take place in Syria, because as soon as the opposition wins, which I think they will do, they're going to get rid of the entire security force that's laden with Alawites and Ba'athists, and they're going to begin to chuck people out of the various ministries that have been disloyal. And they're going to have a lot of people to replace them with, because Syria is very hungry right now. The sanctions are hitting the government hard.
Literally hungry, as in not enough food.
Not enough food. The rest of Syrians are being hit extremely hard, and people are they don't have cooking gas, they don't have heating oil, they're freezing, and there's no food. And this situation, people are using the sort of fat of the land, anything they've saved right now, but that's going to run out, and at some point there's going to be a real humanitarian crisis. And the world's going to have to step forward on that, because the Syrian opposition needs lots of money for guns, but it also needs tons of money just to feed its families.
Ambassador, just a few seconds before the break here, but it sounds like, you know, this is a country that can't live with a change, can't live without a change. It sounds like a recipe for blowing up.
I think that's unfortunately true. I think the situation is going to get worse before there's any visible path forward toward a new government and a new political society in Syria.
Ambassador Edward Djerejian, former U.S. ambassador to Syria and to Israel, please stand by there in Houston, Texas. Joshua Landis in Norman, Oklahoma, at the University of Oklahoma there. Listeners, will come to your calls right after the break. We're talking about the killing and the way forward in Syria. If Assad goes, does civil war have to follow? If civil war really comes, what does that do to the region? Could Syria blow everything up? 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the killing and the way forward in Syria, the bloodbath going on there, the powder keg or all around it, the challenge to the world implicit in it. Ambassador Edward Jerajian joins us from Houston, Texas, director there of the Baker Institute at Rice University, former U.S. ambassador to Syria and to Israel, for that matter. Joshua Landis is with us from the University of Oklahoma, all plugged into Syria there, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at Oklahoma, runs the blog SyriaComment.com. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. What do you see going on here? What should happen here? What shouldn't happen here? The pressure is going to be large. It is already. I mean, the humanitarian impulse that rises here, not to mention all the intersecting interests. But here's a Syrian blogger and activist, Omar Shakir, talking with NPR's Morning Edition just today, out of homes under shelling and heavy machine gun fire, calling on the world to help.
No, there is no one with us. We are depending on you. Maybe they can do something preventing Assad army from killing everybody here in Bab al-Amal. So we are asking for SOS.
SOS, there's the SOS. What do we do? Ambassador Jerajian, Joshua Landis, we've got a lot of callers. Brooks in Providence, Rhode Island. Brooks, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Yes, my name is Brooks. Oh, well, thank you today for bringing me on. Oh, what is going on in Syria right now? We're talking about a human disaster, a bloodbath. Everybody's saying it's going on. But I want to appeal to United Nations. They have done it all over the world, especially in Africa. Africa, most recently, in Ivory Coast. It was a simple election crisis that went on. In France, the United Nations never wait for order. They never wait for permission. They went ahead and bombarded Bado, the president, bombarded him. Right now, he's in a war crime tribunal. They never waited for order.
Brooks, you say go in, do it, and we've got that human disaster right there. I appreciate your call, Donald in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Donald, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, enjoying the program very much.
Thank you.
I think what I've gotten so far is that your guest, a very knowledgeable man, don't know what's going to happen if you leave it alone or if we go in.
Mm-hmm.
And let's err on the side of caution, you know, for once, that we see what we did in Iraq, where al-Maliki is looking more and more like Saddam Hussein every day, and Afghanistan is a disaster. So I don't think we've got a track record that that we can really rely on of going in and making a situation better.
Donald, I think a lot of people may be nodding their head along with that. Absolutely. At the same time, it hurts the heart to hear those shells coming down on suburbs. But we've got it loud and clear. Err on the side of caution. One more here. Stephen in Windham, Connecticut. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just a working class guy. I don't know anything about Chinese oil in Iran or Russia holding on this, you know, ports in the Middle East. I'm reading the Gulf News, and on the front page, there's three little kids that, you know, are dead with blood on their faces. I mean, it just broke my heart, Tom. And I'm thinking to myself, who's going to be their hero? You know, is David Petraeus and Langley going to be their hero? But President Obama, is he just going to ignore this?
So do you want to see kids from your hometown in American military uniforms on those streets to clean it up, Stephen, or what?
If I had my choice, I'd march the whole Western Army in the homes today and protect those little kids. Yes, I would do it. No doubt about it in my mind, Tom.
In spite of what you've seen in Iraq, in spite of what you've seen in Afghanistan, how difficult these things are when you actually get into them.
It's extremely difficult. You're absolutely right. But listen, we can't be moral cowards. There's people are being murdered. It's wholesale murder. We're going to watch this happen.
Stephen, thank you for your call. Josh Landis, let me come first to you and then Ambassador Jerajian. I mean, you can't help wondering, the Syrians are already saying that there are foreign powers behind the uprising. And, you know, we've seen journalists reporting on arms coming into Syria. I mean, are foreign powers already getting involved? Of course, Iran is. They supported Syria for a long time. But Do you already see foreigners trying to do something here or not, Josh?
Yes. You know, already it's very at a very small scale, but Gulf countries, we believe, are beginning to fund the opposition through Turkey. Turkey has given a base for the Free Syrian Army inside Turkey. And Syrians are donating. Of course, Iran is supporting the Syrian government. So is Russia, selling it a lot of arms. Hezbollah is on one side. Syria has friends, and so does the opposition. And I think what we're going to see is increasingly Western powers are going to step up and begin to train, arm, and possibly fund Syrian opposition.
Ambassador Jerajian, how do you see the future for, let's take Western involvement here for a moment. I mean, the president says no military intervention, please. But, of course, what does that mean? Does that mean no boots on the ground? Could the U.S. end up supplying arms to the opposition in Syria or some U.S. proxy? Is that a good idea?
Well, if you look at our position strategically in the Middle East, as you mentioned yourself, the United States is just in the end game of a major military involvement in Iraq, where a great deal of American blood and treasure has been expended. We are massively involved in Afghanistan, which is highly problematic, and again, committing blood and treasure. I think the administration did the right thing in Libya by so-called leading from behind, because we did not have, as Secretary of Defense, then Secretary of Defense Bob Gates said, we didn't have vital interests, but certainly our Western allies, especially Britain, France, and Italy, did. So they took the lead with our very significant military mm-hmm. support in the background. So I think I hear the pain in the comments, I share them, of your callers in the face of these videos we're seeing of the humanitarian disaster that is occurring in Syria. But in terms of the conduct of American policy, we have to always balance our principles, our staunch stance as Americans for democracy and individual liberty, which many of these people in the streets of Syria are advocating, and we're behind them in that. But we also have to balance it out with our national security interests. The United States cannot be the world's policeman in every crisis in the world. But that's short of that, I think we can help. As Josh Landis pointed out, I think there will be a tendency toward corridors, humanitarian corridors that might be established with international help. Turkey is watching with great, great concern what's happening on its southern border with Syria. Turkey has a huge problem with Kurdish dissidents, and there's a large Kurdish population in Syria. So it is going. It has a major national security interest in terms of the Kurdish issue. And also, Turkey does not want to be subject to massive refugee inflows. Already it's taking care of thousands of Syrian refugees on its side of the border. So there may
and
be
Syria
a buffer.
Taking,
there, may,
mm-hmm.
there may be a buffer. Buffer zone that the Turks may establish for their own protection. Mm-hmm. So what I see is that a limited Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has talked about bringing together a coalition of countries because of the failure in the United Nations Security Council because of the Russian and Chinese vetoes to bring together a so-called coalition of the willing of countries that might be able to help the opposition and alleviate the humanitarian disaster.
You start with buffer zones and corridors, and you're soon can be pretty involved in things, but we see that picture. Let's get a call from Bordeaux in France here. Philip, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to respond to the caller from Myrtle Beach. I think taking a look at our track record is exactly what we need to do. For instance, in Cambodia in the 70s, in the Bosnian War, these are examples when we did err on the side of caution and to great cost. A coalition of the willing is, in light of the failure of the UN, at this point, something like that may be our only option, but a firm response, we're moving beyond the point of words here, and it's only going to get worse. I'll take my response off the air.
Thank you, Philip. In France, don't want to see another Rwanda. I mean, look carefully at Cambodia. You got U.S. boots all around that area that, you know, may have helped bring that chaos about. Things can get really tricky when you get in big. Omar in Orlando, Florida. Omar, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. I just want to quickly touch on the fact that, you know, yesterday we heard from Clinton and Rice about how outraged and shocked they were at the veto by the Russians and Chinese. But, you know, this has double standards written all over it because, you know, for a long time now, the U.S. is usually the sole power on the council that when it comes to Israel, they have no problem vetoing, many resolutions. That would condemn Israel for their actions, what they do in Gaza and to the Palestinians. And also, you know, we keep hearing democratic reforms being offered by the Arab League, but Arab League is led by two of the most oppressive and extremist regimes in the region, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And also, you know, we're taking a lesson from Libya. You know, we had a huge, you know, pep rallies and cheerleaders of saying, oh, well, you know, we're going to support these democratic movements in Libya, yet Doctors Without Borders just announced last week that they're leaving their mission because, you know, the same side that we supported is now carrying out tortures and rape and killing of the other side.
So what's your concern in Syria, Omar? What's your concern there or your prescription?
Well, I think that, you know, there is a legitimate democratic movement there, but, you know, that these videos and these calls that we're getting from certain activists, I mean, these basically sound just like replays of the Libyan situation. I mean, we should really get a real look inside about what's going on. I mean, I know it's hard to get in because of what the government has done, but, you know, there's just as many videos and stuff online that show, you know, actions of the Free Syrian Army and what they're doing and some of the things they've done to people who may or may not be on one side or the other.
Omar, are you personally, I'm wondering, are you worried about what happens to the Alawite ruling population or the Christians?
Alawite Christians, I mean, it's not just, unfortunately, you know, the Western powers, we've been taking sides between conflicts in the Middle East that have been around longer than the U.S. have, but whether it's Shiite Sunni, whether it's Muslim Christian, you know, for some reason it comes down to these religious sides that end up being created. And, I mean, honestly, who really benefits from this? Yep. There's one side that benefits Saudi Arabia, and there's one side that benefits Iran. The Shia-Sunni war is nothing more than just a cover for the Arab-Persian war that existed way before Islam ever came around.
We're into big calculus, Omar. We've got that, but at the same time, there's history here. It's been brutal for a long time under the Assad family, and it's brutal right now in Homs. Josh Landis, here's a listener online. Dan writes, can you ask your guests how they think things would turn out if the U.S. and Europe took a step back from this situation and started taking a backseat to regional actors such as Saudi Arabia and Turkey? That's kind of what Ambassador Derejian may be suggesting here. With what possible consequences, Josh Landis?
Well, I was just in Saudi Arabia a few weeks ago, and I asked a number of Saudi princes if they would lead the way, because at the time, the Arab League had monitors there, and the U.S. was very much, I believe, hoping that the Arab League would step forward. Either Turkey or the Arab League would lead, and the U.S. could come in behind and supply the sort of air power and other things that they didn't have. They said, no, we're not going to intervene militarily in a fellow, you know, through the Arab League, in a fellow Arab country like Syria. That's not what Saudi Arabia does. And I think Turkey, for the reasons that Ambassador Derejian has pointed out, because of the Kurdish question and other internal questions in Turkey, doesn't want to step into the middle of this Syrian, possibly, quagmire. So everybody, we've got a you-first situation here where everybody is saying, you go first, but nobody wants to step in because Iraq is there for everybody to see, Afghanistan, what can happen if you get into sort of a failed state and try to sort it out. Then you need to take responsibility for nation building and for deciding who's going to be the winners and then providing security and food for the people afterwards. It is a nightmare, and I think many of your callers have underlined that. On the other hand, there is this humanitarian problem, and nobody wants to stand on the sidelines.
Humanitarian and, for that matter, political. There's been plenty of repression there. Barbara in New York City. Barbara, thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was in Syria a few months ago as a tourist. Mm-hmm. And what I was struck by was the immense propaganda machine that Assad has around every inch of the country, which I think makes it very hard for regular Syrians to even know what's going on. And I think even when I was there, people were oblivious to so much that I was getting news about. The machine is huge. I mean, Assad's machine is in every inch of the country.
No question about that, though I guess if you're under the gun, you know it very well. But outside that ring of fire could be a different story. A lot of media control there. Thanks, Barbara. Ambassador Derejian, pull the curtain back here a little more because there's been so much talk in recent weeks and days. Josh Landis mentioned it as well, the sort of war drums around Iran and its nuclear program. New sounds from Israel saying they may go in there. How do these things intersect, Ambassador? If we get conflict over Iran while Syria is still at this boil, what's the interplay of chemistry here?
Well, now we're really talking about worst-case scenarios.
Well, I mean, we have to at least consider it. It seems to be, you know, it's out there.
Right. No, absolutely. But the point here is, first, in terms of the connectivity between Iran and Syria and Hezbollah, events are dictating the demise of Iranian influence in Syria. There's no grand conspiracy. Washington or London or Riyadh have not concocted this scenario so that Iran's influence will diminish. These are events. This is a bottom-up revolution. It's part of the Arab Spring. And Iran is already a loser in Syria because this regime, Assad's regime, is in the endgame. We don't know exactly when, but it's going to be a terrible, prolonged agony perhaps, but it's in the end game. So Iran, that stakes so much on a strategic alliance with Syria, is losing in the Levant. Hezbollah is now less capable of receiving the financial, military, political, and other support that it got through Syria and because of Syria's alliance with Iran. But these things are happening not because of any grand plot or strategy, but because of events.
Still, there could be conflict. We have 1 minute. What if it goes toward conflict? How does that?
If it does go, I think the worst thing that can happen is in the current scenarios where we're seeing in the Middle East is to have a military action in Iran, which will then have unintended consequences that will just put the whole region into much greater turmoil than we're seeing today.
I mean, are you talking about, I mean, could we see military conflict, you know, in that whole arc from Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, right across?
In the worst case scenario, yes.
And that's if we get into a shooting match somehow, I don't even know who we is, but with Iran.
Well, I think President Obama recently made a statement a few days ago in which the stress is really on international sanctions on Iran and diminishing the prospects of military action. There's a lot of talk about military action, but I think the wiser course at this stage is to pursue the sanctions and the diplomatic route.
Ambassador Edward Derejian joining us from Houston, Texas, and the Baker Institute at Rice University. Thank you, Ambassador.
You're welcome.
Joshua Landis at the University of Oklahoma, thank you for being with us today.
A pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
This is On Point.